This is The Country Hour, and you're with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Well, hello. How's your afternoon panning out? Hopefully good, and glad you found some time to be here as part of The Country Hour, and hope you can be part of the conversation. Text through anytime you like, 0448 922 604, to text through your thoughts between now and 1 o'clock. Picking up on the egg story, and I was talking about this with you yesterday, just going through some of the details, those submissions, 100,000 submissions. It's a record, apparently, into this draft national welfare code for the poultry industry. And a lot of those submissions along the lines of being anti-caged egg production. Shortly, you're going to hear from an animal behaviour and welfare associate professor. He's been around for years, 25 years in the business. He thinks that a ban on caged egg production is inevitable. So I'll get his thoughts for you shortly. And it appears feral pigs are moving east. In the last few months, feral pig sightings have been made in areas of the Great Southern that rarely get these sort of reports. Annabelle Garrett from the Wagen Woodnilling Landcare Group says a number of reports have come in of late from the Wagen Shire.
Pigs haven't officially been recorded to this degree out here for quite a long time, or forever, to my understanding. We've sort of had since, I guess, late last year, we've had five or six people coming in with concerns that they're seeing pigs in larger numbers than they would have. They used to see one or two every now and then. They're seeing, you know, groups of six to eight now, and whole families of pigs coming through, and little ones, and this sort of thing.
Yeah, those pigs being sighted in the Wagen Shire. What have you seen? What's happening at your place? The text 0448 922 604. 7 past 12 here on The Country Hour, ABC WA. Well, you know, there are a lot of calls for more work to be done to cut Australia's emissions, and those calls have been around for a long time. And in light of that, the federal government's Green Investment Bank is today, it's unveiled its first equity investment in the agricultural sector. The Clean Energy Finance Corporation is getting together with the Macquarie Group and the CSIRO to cut farming emissions and establish new efficiency standards. RN Breakfast's Hamish McDonald spoke with the corporation's chief executive, Ian Learmonth, who says the $100 million investment is going to focus specifically on horticulture and grain crops.
And that $100 million will be combined with other investors, and it will acquire cropping and agricultural properties around the countryside, and we'll try and introduce more efficient agricultural practices across the board. So we're very excited about it. We're working with the CSIRO as well, and we're going to introduce measures, ratios around energy efficiency and emissions reduction to try and improve emissions in the agricultural sector.
But what are we talking about specifically, though? It's things like solar panels, helping farmers get better finance for more carbon efficient tractors and that kind of thing.
Well, there's some of that. Of course, we will be putting pressure on those operators to put solar panels, inverters, and batteries onto their properties, but as well as introducing technologies like precision agriculture. So the GPS tracking of the planting of seeds and fertilisers to try and reduce the use of diesel and electricity on the properties to ultimately reduce emissions.
Is it correct that the farming sector actually emits more than coal and other mining?
No, the agricultural sector emits about 13% of CO2 across the economy. Now, a lot of that, or the majority of that, is in fact in the pastoral sector, so livestock, but a significant amount of CO2 does come from the cropping sector. So there is a challenge that we're trying to tackle here.
So why tackle the cropping if the majority of it comes from livestock farming?
Well, because this is a great opportunity that has been presented to the CEFC, and we're very much looking forward to putting our capital that way. We are working with other companies across the livestock sector as well, and we hope to be announcing transactions down the track in that sector.
So you will move into looking at that space of livestock
Absolutely.
Farming.
We look right across the economy, and down the track we will be investing in that space.
Why has it taken so long to get major equity investment in the agricultural sector, given the contribution it makes to our overall emissions?
Well, as you probably know, there are over 80,000 farms across Australia. They're mainly owned by families and not in the corporate sector. So it's been people like Macquarie who've taken a step in to being, I guess, a corporate investor in the agricultural sector. And that's opened up opportunities for people like ourselves and other commercial investors to put capital into the ag sector.
But that doesn't really answer the question of why it's taken so long.
Well, I think it's been just the way that particular sector has evolved. It's been in the hands of really the individuals for many years, and it's just efficiencies and corporate strategies around that sector have taken a bit of a while to emerge.
I want to ask you about low emissions vehicles. Earlier this month, you announced a deal to offer low interest rates to businesses that lease low emissions cars, like electric and hybrid cars. There's some division though in the federal government at the moment over how much support should be given to electric cars. Given we're so far behind the rest of the world on this front, do you think the government should be subsidising or encouraging their take-up in some way?
Look, it's a very interesting question. I mean, if you look at Australia at the moment, only 0.1% of vehicles are electric today, in comparison to places like Norway that have up to 13, 14% of their vehicles are electric. Now, that has been a result in Scandinavian countries of subsidies and concessions and tax breaks and so on. We are providing cheap finance for people to take up electric vehicles. And we're encouraging the development of that market. We would like governments, both state and federal, to look at ways to encourage people to take up EVs. And look, we hope that will happen.
Liberal backbencher Craig Kelly has suggested that electric cars produce more emissions than petrol cars. Is that right?
Not sure that is quite right.
Us a straight answer.
Well,
the key,
Hamish, is that we've got to decarbonise the electricity sector so that when everyone fills up their electric vehicles with power, they're filling it up with low emission power rather than going around with a car full of electricity that's been generated by fossil fuels. So that's another very important thing. And once we do that, then electric vehicles will have a huge jump on internal combustion engine
cars.
Is it
inevitable that we'll follow these other countries and end up taking up a lot more of them?
I think there's no question that's the way we're heading. You look at the manufacturers of vehicles, they are all moving that way. They're talking about stopping, making internal combustion engine cars in the next 10, 15 years. We need more models available here in Australia, and we need the prices to come down so that consumers here in Australia are going to be motivated to buy cheaper vehicles.
12 past 12, ABC WA, that's the Clean Energy Finance Corporation's Chief Executive, Ian Learmonth, talking about how that corporation has teamed up with the Macquarie Group and the CSIRO to cut farming emissions and establish some new efficiency standards. Be part of the conversation today on text 0448 922 604. Tony Ma is the CEO of the National Farmers Federation. So let's get a bit of an insight into what's happening at the ground level, I guess. Tony, how significant a priority is it for the agricultural sector to cut its emissions?
Well, afternoon, Belinda. We're very supportive of investment in the sector. I mean, we think that the agriculture industry can be a $100 billion industry by 2030. So that's the aspiration that we've made. And included in underneath that is being more efficient. And that obviously includes energy. Energy costs and then emissions are a key issue for the sector. So it's around getting a more affordable, more reliable energy source right across the country, and that's complex enough, but it's also about looking on farm, practical measures that reduce emissions and strike that right balance between affordability and reliability and sustainability. So it's a key issue, and agriculture, representing around about 13% of emissions overall, the sector is well placed to help Australia reduce its emissions.
Well, with that in mind, has the ag sector been really too slow to approach this, to tackle this, considering it is one of the significant contributors to it all?
Well, it's a pretty complex area, as you'd appreciate, and one of the things that hasn't helped around this is policy uncertainty. I mean, we've had successive governments over the last decade or so trying to address not only the energy issue, as I say, around affordability and reliability, but also the policy settings that are going to drive reductions in emissions and getting the science right. And that has been really one of the issues for the agriculture sector, is the methodologies that allow us to, A, understand what the emissions are from the various sectors, so whether that's beef or grain production or dairy or pork or any other sector, and then actually doing something about it. So getting the data and getting the measuring, the metrics right, and then putting in place the tools that allow us to actually reduce that. So it's pretty complex. So I'd say there's been a few contributing factors around making sure that agriculture can play its part.
And Tony, considering it is a complex issue and some people still coming to terms with it and grasping what we're talking about, have you got a couple of practical examples of what we're talking about in terms of what can be done on the farm to reduce some of these emissions?
Yeah, so there's a few different sectors or organisations trying to address this issue. And again, at the end of the day for us, it's about efficiencies on farm and also potential opportunities for farmers to have alternative income streams. So things like on-farm genetic selection for cattle that produce less emissions, potential use of vaccines and things that reduce, you know, methane production, carbon farming, sequestration as well as other innovations. So for cropping, looking at, you know, reduced or more efficient use of fertilisers or low-till production methods, and low-till, you know, production has been in place within agriculture for some time. But there's more innovation. So precision agriculture, using digital technology to allow us to be more efficient with the resources. So whether that's fertiliser, whether that's chemical, or whether that's actual diesel being burnt in tractors to make crops more productive and more efficient with the resources that we've got at hand. So it's quite, can be quite practical measures in terms of low-till or no-till, but it all can also can be quite scientific in terms of genetic selection of cattle, for example.
And it's a fine balancing act, I imagine, because, you know, on the one hand, there's that increasing demand for protein from around the world, so that means more livestock on your farm, I guess, at the same time trying to balance out your emissions that are coming from each individual farm. How do you get that balance right?
Well, in a challenging way, I was going to say with difficulty, but it is a challenge, absolutely right. I mean, you push down on one particular area, around productivity, trying to get the most out of your particular resources, you do have to have an eye on what the implications of that might mean. So, you know, you're trying to get the balance between energy efficiency, for example, and what that might mean for water use. There really does have to be, you know, despite the cliche, that whole environmental, economic and social perspective or lens that you have to look through to get that balance. It can be done, but it needs a, you know, a comprehensive approach, and it'll differ from sector to sector and probably farm to farm. And that's another reason why the sector, because we've got, you know, 80 or 100,000 farms right across Australia, with each farm just being that slightly different, dealing with their own environmental issues in particular regions. So there are all of those complexities. But needless to say, the sector is trying to embrace this, trying to adapt and use new technology and new processes to drive efficiencies on farm.
Just to wrap up for us, Tony, is there money in it for farmers? I mean, it's not just that feel good, we're reducing emissions and doing the right thing by the environment. By embracing some of these technologies, there is money in it for the individual farmer to go down that track?
Look, absolutely. And the decision today, or the announcement today by the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, is a really good example of the investment that is required in Australian agriculture to take us towards that $100 billion industry. So the investment is one thing, and that will play a part to help us to move forward. The other thing, as you say, is that there are opportunities for individual farmers. So whether that's tree planting or it results in more improvements in cash flow on farm because of the use of, or less use of, fertilisers or chemicals or other inputs, that can save farm businesses money. So that will drive an increased return for farmers as well.
Tony, good to catch up. Thank you for that. Tony Ma is the CEO of the National Farmers Federation. And talking this afternoon about reducing those emissions on farm. The agricultural sector is one of the big contributors to those emissions. And there's a move on today with the announcement from the federal government teaming up with a group of different people, the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, the Macquarie Group and CSIRO, to cut farming emissions. There's a lot of work already being done by the sounds of things. Hearing there from Tony at the National Farmers Federation, 20 past 12. Well, let's take it down, even drilling further down, and look here in Western Australia at some of the work that's being done. Richard McClelland is the CEO of the Northern Agricultural Council right here in Western Australia. He's also on the board of Farmers for Climate Action. Now, Richard, you're based in Geraldton. What do you think farmers in the Northern Wheat Belt will think of this push to cut farming emissions and establish new efficiency standards?
I think there'd be a lot of interest in this, Blend. I think every farmer, like Tony was saying, every farmer is looking for an opportunity to minimise their costs and maximise their returns. And an initiative like this one will certainly be helpful to that.
All right. Do you think anyone sees it as a threat to their business?
Absolutely not. No. I think most farmers these days, as I said, they're trying to minimise their inputs and maximise their outputs, and anything that's going to help them, that will be provide them with an economic benefit as well as being a win-win for the environment, for the climate, I think they'll be all ears.
All right, so let's have a look at what's actually being done, what's happening on the ground. Do you have some examples in your area from looking around at what farmers might be doing to reduce their emissions right now?
Exactly. So there's a lot of farmers already heading down this road, and I think this new initiative will certainly be a helping hand and help put more information out. I'm really impressed with the Queensland Farmers Federation and their Energy Savers program that they have, and looking forward to that kind of being extended over the whole nation through this initiative. But here in our region, we've got farmers, some of whom are members of Farmers for Climate Action, who are really conscious of this. And there's been a strong and steady movement around practices like no-till and controlled traffic farming, that precision agriculture that Tony talked about. But there's also increasing energy efficiency to be gained on farms, and you've seen it for some time, increasing use of solar and micro-energy programs. A lot of stuff being done around residue management and nutrient management and water efficiency, these kinds of things. And I think the bottom line is people are trying to minimise their energy and electricity costs in particular, but they want to use less diesel and put out less pollution in the process.
And the announcement today from the federal government just saying it really wants to make a push on this, and those three organisations getting together to try and really move it forward. Do you think that's going to be a motivator for individual farmers or industries here in WA?
No, I think so. I think farmers realise that, certainly in this day and age with the global markets, that producing a lot of output is not necessarily the game. It's the quality of what we want to produce. And I think Australia has got a real niche already with a clean and green image, and so we want to be able to protect that. I think if farmers can embrace this kind of initiative and demonstrate that they are minimising their energy use and minimising their emissions, it'll only add to that image that we have overseas.
How do you think these new efficiency standards will affect horticulture producers in and around Gingin or Mora, for example?
I think they'll be very, very interested. I think, once again, farmers in horticulture in particular are looking at making huge efficiencies around their water use and trying to make sure that they use less water but also use better technologies for irrigation and pumping. And so I think they'll be looking for this initiative to see whether it can give them a helping hand, whether it's in information or new technologies or whatever.
Good to talk to you and get that closer look at what's happening on the ground, well, around your area, around the Geraldton way anyway, Richard. Thank you for being part of the show today.
Thanks, Belinda.
Richard McClelland, he's the CEO of the Northern Agricultural Council here in WA, and he's also on the board of Farmers for Climate Action. If you're doing something along these lines, let me know, 0448 922 604. Anthony in Broome Hill has sent through this text. He says, why not use all the BS, you know what I'm talking about, as fertiliser? Set up a methane digester in Parliament. There's so much there, but don't talk about the recent APRA bill passage in both houses in a conspiracy between the left and right nasty parties. 0448 922 604 to be in touch today. 24 past 12, ABC WA, this is The Country Hour. Belinda Varischetti with you. Shortly, look at the news headlines and the weather right around Western Australia. We'll see if well, I think it's ex-tropical cyclone Kelvin, is still causing any rainfall in parts of northern and eastern parts of the state, and it's how it's going to track into the Southwest Land Division too. Before that, a Charles Sturt University researcher is calling for poultry welfare to be improved here in Australia. As we were talking about yesterday, you'll recall, this record 100,000 submissions have been made on a draft national welfare code for poultry, and they're anti-caged eggs. Animal Behaviour and Welfare Associate Professor Dr. Raph Fayer has been a poultry researcher for 25 years. He's worked around the world, the United Kingdom, the United States, and he's now based here in Australia at Wagga Wagga. And he says Australian poultry standards should be meeting consumer demands, and a ban on caged egg production is inevitable.
We're beginning to see a market for high welfare produce, both in eggs and the meat, people buying free-range eggs, free-range chicken meat, which are higher welfare standards, and I think the public need reassurance that those items are animal welfare standards. Now, to some extent, when we see a social movement like that, that's irrespective of what's going on at the regulation level. We're talking about minimum standards today, which is basically, if you treat poultry worse than that, more or less loosely be considered criminal activity. Yet we're seeing farmers and we're seeing consumers really committed to far higher levels of welfare.
Do you think caged egg production is criminal activity?
Well, it isn't at the moment. It is in some other countries around the world. In the whole of the European Union, it's probably the biggest producer. There's some very well-known disadvantages to keeping poultry in cages, laying hens in cages. Those are well established in the scientific literature, to the point that very few people are doing research in this area because we know the effect that cages has on laying hen welfare. Partly what we're seeing in this country that we've been seeing in the past 10 years has been a very strong drop in demand for caged eggs. When I came to Australia 12 years ago, about 90% of the market was caged eggs. Now it's just about 50%. So I think we have our answer there as to what the public think, whether cages are suitable for laying hens or not.
Do you think there is a future for it in Australia?
I think the movement in around the world, and I think the movement in New Zealand too, which are taking a much harder stance on caged egg production, are going to influence the Australian market. Now, it can only stay immune to those forces for so long, is my impression. And I think the trend that we've seen for the past 10 years is going to continue.
From your perspective as a researcher, what do you think is the best way for eggs to be produced in Australia?
You've got to understand that there's two parts to that question. One is my position as a scientist, and the other is my personal position, which is an ethical decision. Now, just because I've been working for 25 years in a field doesn't make me any more of an expert in the ethical position than anybody else on the street. But purely as a scientist, I think we've seen that cages, and more importantly, whatever we do to a cage system isn't going to improve welfare. And we're seeing much higher standards of welfare in well-designed alternative systems, large group, free range. And we have some of those in this region that are really well, really high up on welfare. And I think if the science is there to provide information to the public, then the information is quite clear to the public that a well-managed free-range or large group system is much better for laying hens, and some lower stocking density, slower growth rates are much better for meat chickens.
That's Charles Sturt University Associate Professor Dr. Raph Fayer speaking to Cara Jeffrey at the Poultry Industry Welfare Meeting, which is on at Wagga Wagga. ABC WA, it is 29 past 12, and Michaela Carr in the studio to talk you through the news headlines.
Hi, Belinda. Former WA Nationals leader Terry Redman has refused to apologise for management of the Royalties for Regions program, saying the party fixed a sad legacy of underinvestment in the regions. A new report has found the scheme destabilised the government's financial management processes and allocated funds in a knee-jerk and ad hoc way. The Home Affairs Minister Minister Peter Dutton has slapped down Tony Abbott's proposal to cut Australia's migration intake, warning it could cost the economy billions of dollars. The former Prime Minister has again called for immigration to be reduced, saying it would help ease cost of living pressures as well as crime rates. The Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has called for an international peace conference on the Middle East to be held by mid-year. And the Western Fury vice-captain Nicole Bolton says her team is happy to go into the Women's National Cricket League final as underdogs. The Fury will meet the New South Wales Breakers in Saturday's decider in Sydney. Belinda, I'll be back with more news at 1 o'clock.
Well, thank you for that, Michaela. And just picking up on one of the stories you mentioned there, this text through from yours truly on Terry Redmond. If the Nationals really believed in their own electorate, royalties for regions money would have been spent on essential infrastructure, for example, roads and railways, not the good time club things. $7 billion equals 7,000 kilometres of new roads. It was a very clever vote-catching ploy from yours truly. So we'll have some more details in that in the 1 o'clock.
We will indeed.
Thank you so much for that. Also talking about caged eggs here on the country, just a moment ago, that a poultry industry, talking about poultry industry welfare, there's a meeting on in Wagga Wagga, and heard from Dr. Raph Frayer from Chester University. This from Callum in Katanning. I'm sick of hearing about wanting to ban cage eggs because everyone wants free range. If people didn't buy caged eggs, no one would produce them. That the market sorted out, not legislation. Thanks for that, Callum. 0448 922 604 is the text. Still to come between now and that news bulletin at 1 o'clock. A closer look at the avocado industry, catching up with another of the Nuffield scholars, the 2018 scholars. This is Dudley Mitchell. We spent we've travelled the world. It sounds fabulous. South America, Chile, Peru, California, Israel, South Africa and New Zealand, all looking at what they're doing with avocados in their countries and what we can learn from that and maybe apply here in Australia. Also, and very shortly, looking at the feral pig situation and looking into the northern wheat belt and really trying to understand how to keep feral pig numbers under control. What's behind that increasing number of feral pigs? Looking at that story shortly. First, off to the Weather Bureau. Austin Watkins with you this afternoon. Austin, what's the story in northern eastern parts of Western Australia?
Well, we've got the remnants of TC Kelvin through the south interior at the moment, and that's going to make its way south over the next sort of 18 to 24 hours, eventually moving off the Eucla coast tomorrow morning. So we'll see some heavy rainfall and the odd thunderstorm through the Eucla during the morning, but that'll clear off before sort of sunrise, and then we'll see quite a number of showers through the south interior, the Goldfields and the Eucla, with all the remnant moisture from that system, but those showers will ease during the day. To the north, we've got a trough through the Kimberley and the Pilbara, and that'll trigger some afternoon showers and storms, mainly through the Kimberley, Pilbara and the north interior. Those showers and storms will continue into Friday, with the trough still lingering through there. The showers further to the south and over the southeast will have cleared, so generally clear conditions over the southeast of the state. By Saturday, the trough will develop a little bit further through the Pilbara, but once again, still showers and storms, seasonal kind of things through the Kimberley and the Pilbara, and then continuing on Sunday once again with the trough still lingering through that area.
All right, let's have a look at the South West Land Division. What are the details?
So we've got a trough just inland from the coast today, and that'll linger into Thursday before moving inland during the day. So mainly clear conditions through the western half of the Southwest Land Division tomorrow, but just a bit of moisture feeding over from the moisture from ex-tropical cyclone Kelvin. So just some showers over the far eastern half of the Southwest Land Division and along the south coast to the east of Walpole. By Friday, that trough will be inland, and we may see a little bit of shower activity in the wake of that trough along the lower west coast, the southwest district, and along the south coast as well. And just some isolated showers developing in the afternoon on the trough in the far east of the wheat belt. By Saturday, we'll see the high move into the Bight and a redevelopment of the trough down the west coast, and that's going to bring some unsettled weather to the northern southwest land division, eventually creeping down towards the lower west and the northern parts of the Great Southern, and just some morning shower activity along the south coast. And then by Sunday, the trough will deepen further but move inland during the day, so we'll see the showers and thunderstorm activity right through the southwest land division, eventually clearing away from the west coast during the afternoon.
And Austin, any warnings for us today?
We've got a severe weather warning in place for the South Interior and the Eucla. We've also got a number of flood warnings through the Interior and the Western Kimberley. And we've also got a strong wind warning for the Eucla Coast and the Leeuwin Coast.
Thank you for the wrap.
No worries.
Austin Watkins with the details from the Weather Bureau today. Let's now take a look at the rainfall figures. Richard Hudson has those details.
Feel like the desk is a bit low today. I'm down on my knees. Michaela's a bit short. Up in the Kimberley, not too much around. These are the figures 5 mils and over. Bidgidanga 6, Kalumburu 8, and Lake Argyle Research Station 6, and Udiella had 8 millimetres. In the Pilbara region, Boddy Downs 10. In the Gascoyne, no rainfall at all recorded, unfortunately. In the interior, Carnegie 36, Cunyu 8, Granite Peak 11, Lorna Glen 5, Prenti Downs 25, Chookyella 20, and Warburton at the airfields 7. In the goldfields, Jindalby 10, Laverton 5, and Seymour Downs 25. In the Eucla district, Eucla 6, Eyre 9, Forest 6, Rawlinna at the depot 23, Rawlinna Homestead 12, I'm sure they're happy, and Red Rocks Point 13. No rainfall on the islands and nothing really worth reporting except in the southern coastal region where Esperance at the airport had 6, the Duke always likes to get a mention with 7, and Windrush had 6 mils over 4 days.
Thanks for the wrap, Richard. 24 to 1.
This is the Country Hour, and you're with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
News at 1 before the news. We're back at... No, we're not. We've done Muse. It's Wednesday. It's hump day. We're off to Katanning. And Tracy Kilner will have the details of the Katanning sheep market for you just before that news bulletin at 1 o'clock. Let's head into the Northern Wheat Belt now, because there is quite a bit of work being done in this patch to get a better understanding of how to keep feral pig numbers under control. Now, the area I'm talking to you about, it's the Northampton region, just north of Geraldton, and this is where the Northern Biosecurity Group is working with the Department of Primary Industries, trying to do something about these numbers. And this is just a few of the things that are going on. They've installed monitoring cameras. They're conducting infrared drone surveys. And earlier this week, the project took to the skies using a helicopter to conduct an aerial cull. Lucinda Jose was curious and went along for a look and soon realised the group is doing more than just killing the odd pig.
We've got a helicopter for the day and a shooter, and we're just aiming for the feral pigs and trying to just see what sort of numbers they're doing, if it's cost effective.
Scott Bridgman is a Northampton farmer and member of the Northern Biosecurity Group committee. He says the region has everything a feral pig could need.
It's a very big area for a lot of scrub and natural vegetation with a lot of water sources, so it's very hard to control them by vehicles. So people have been trapping and dogs and all the rest of it, but the numbers are still breeding up, so this was just another angle and a way of doing it, and hopefully, well, from the results we've got so far, it seems to be working pretty well.
The helicopter's been up once today. How did they go?
The first round, I think they did an hour, and they did 97 pigs, I think, and I think they've gone up for another hour since then and got another 105, so I think the result was very good for the amount that we've done in a short time. We haven't done a lot of the area yet, only just tip of the iceberg.
Hi, I'm Brad. I run farms in the Northampton area. They can have a considerable impact on particularly the lupins in the early stages, but then in the wheat crops at a later stage, they can do a lot of damage.
What does it look like? What can you see when you come up on an area where the pigs have been running amok?
In the lupins, they seem to get into it 3 or 4 days after it germinates, and they can literally make the paddock look like it's been replowed. You know, they can do that much damage. They can take it all out. We've had areas of up to 30, 40 hectares totally wiped out.
The final count hasn't come in, but they're looking at taking out, you know, a good couple of hundred of pigs out of this region today. What sort of an impact would that have on the farmers who are here?
Hopefully it'll have some imprint, but we're still a bit unsure of the total numbers. So, yeah, hopefully it will impact.
As soon as the helicopter is up, I jump in a ute with some of the people who've come to help, including DAFWA Development Officer Dr. Peter Adams, who'll be taking measurements and conducting autopsies on some of the feral pigs.
Well, right now we're on our way across a couple of paddocks. We're looking for some pigs that were shot as part of an aerial cull program this morning, and we're off to grab ourselves a bit of data.
What sort of data are we collecting?
Well, we're going to find out just exactly what age and weight, sex and pregnancy status these shot pigs are, and we're also going to have a look and see in their stomachs just what they've been eating to try and determine exactly what kind of impact these pigs are having.
We're just driving up on a pig in the middle of the paddock.
Black and white boar.
What is it?
A black and white spotted boar.
As you might expect, it gets a bit messy from here. But Peter provided some fascinating information. The gestational period for pigs is just 3 months and 3 days. The animals reach sexual maturity within the first 6 months of life, and after that, sows can have 2 litters a year. So you can see how the population increases quickly.
Maybe how much canola then?
It's the middle of February and the paddocks in the Northampton region are dry. Despite this, the pigs are finding plenty to eat. The stomachs examined contained well-chewed lupins, green canola and canola seed.
Well, this information is going to be very useful at putting together a database of feral pig impact, so we know what they're eating. We can look at their diet as the season changes to see if their diet changes. But also we've got some ongoing monitoring, and the information that we get from these animals in terms of their size, their age, their sex, we can use that to compare to what we're seeing with our other monitoring techniques to get a handle on what the population, what the demographics are of the feral pig population, and we can work out, try and get an idea of whether the population is expanding, as we strongly believe it is, and what sort of influence our control techniques are having on it.
It's pretty dry, the middle of February, and if you look around, the paddocks are pretty bare. Are you surprised that they're finding so much to eat?
Yeah, I am actually quite surprised. These pigs, they're survivors. If there's food available, they'll make the most of it. They'll do what they can to get what they need. But yeah, I'm actually very surprised at the amount of nutrition that these pigs are managing to rustle up in these paddocks. It's certainly not a bare dinner plate, that's for sure.
And would he be what you would consider a healthy specimen?
Absolutely. Most of these pigs, unfortunately, are very healthy specimens running around. Yes, he's in very good condition, and certainly he would be very happily breeding with any sow that was happy to look his way.
Oh, dear. The helicopter is back. Marika Jensen, who coordinates the Northern Biosecurity Group, is getting the final tally for day one.
Yeah, we did 3 separate flights and our total tally was close to 290 pigs. So I'm pretty happy with that number. I said, if we get, close to 50 pigs an hour, we're doing really well and we got that number. So I'm happy.
50 pigs an hour, you think it's cost effective. How much does an exercise like this cost?
Oh, I still have to get the final figures together because we were obviously hiring a chopper and a pilot. We also contracting a shooter and the ammunition and the fuel. It all adds up. So I'm thinking it'll be close to $6,000 a day, I think.
And what sort of an impact are you hoping that 290-odd pigs is going to have on the population here?
Well, I think the big question is how many pigs are here in this area, in the Northampton area. And February is a good time to go and control them because they're hanging out near the watering points or the creeks. People say in winter they move around, they go inland more as well. So with the work that we're doing now and the monitoring, we're also flying drones with infrared cameras. So hopefully we can do a good guesstimate of numbers that are present. And based on that, we can say, we took out X% this week. But then the trick is to keep the control going. So otherwise, you know, we take out the pigs, but they'll just move in and continue to breed.
Marika Jansen from the Northern Biosecurity Group with Lucinda Jose. And the final tally over 2 days was 512 pigs and 9 foxes, which the community was pretty happy about. If you're in the Northampton Chapman Valley area, the Northern Biosecurity Group is holding a community baiting day for pigs, foxes and rabbits in Yuna on the 9th of March. But a pretty impressive effort to do something about the pigs, the monitoring cameras, the infrared drone surveys, and as we've just been hearing, a helicopter taken to the sky to conduct an aerial cull. This from Matt. Give me a break. Cameras, what the heck do they do? Dogs and choppers are the only thing that will work. ABC WA, 12:45. Do you grow avocados? Well, if you do, you need to become more efficient in your crop production. You need to maximise your yields, get better at this, maximising yields, and also lengthening the seasons. That's according to the 2018 Nuffield scholar Dudley Mitchell, who is going to spend this year researching high-density stocking in avocados and also the canopy management. He says those conventional growing methods that we use here in Australia to grow avocados needs to change a little because it takes its toll on water and land resources. And as we move into a more global market, growers need to have a look at some new methods.
Well, the average planting density in Australia is about 340 trees per hectare. You know, the Chileans are experimenting with 6,000 trees per hectare. So if we look at those two figures, we've got a long way to grow. They've been, you know, 5 or 6 years experimenting with those sorts of densities.
And so what kind of advantage would those kind of densities, hypothetically, I guess you're going to be looking into this, what could they bring?
What we know about high-density orchards is that they yield more earlier. In terms of management, it costs a little bit more to run a high-density orchard, but what we're looking for is an increase in productivity per unit of cost.
And why is something like that necessary? Maybe not now, but into the future?
We are going to be competing in a more global supply chain, and so we're going to have to get more efficient in how we grow avos, and we're going to have to get better productivity from what we're growing on now.
Is there also a driver of the fact that the avocado price probably can't sustain itself at what it is for that much longer?
Yeah, I think that is, you know, our medium to long term projections are that prices will come down to more of a global average. And if that's the case, then we really have to increase our productivity.
One of Australia's advantages when it comes to just the international market is the quality of our avocados. So if we were to go into a more high-density system, is that going to reduce quality?
No, not necessarily. Australia is still battling with, you know, 20% of the retail sales that we have are actually turn out to be not so good. So we're really trying to get that 20% down. I think that's one of the strategic plans for the Avocados Australia for the next 3 years. So that is a focus. But high-density production actually sometimes increases your pack out. You get a better result for your avos, yeah.
And the other aspect to it is the canopy management. Where does that come into this and how important is that?
This is one of the main aspects of high-density production. You know, all farmers are basically harvesting light to produce whatever they end up producing, and avocados are no different. It's got a very high energy component because it's an oil-based crop, so we really need to maximize our light interception in the orchard. So the Israelis actually have done a lot of work on this, and they're probably the leaders in research into light interception in orchards, and we'll be looking at that in the Nuffield.
In the southwest, there is a grower who's looking at trellising his avocado trees. Do you see that as something that avocados would look like in the future?
Yeah, potentially it can happen. The South Africans have been doing trellising experiments for about 2 or 3 years. It's more suited to some of the more upright varieties like Maluma, probably Reed. Hass might be a little bit more difficult to control in a trellis system, but there's no reason why we can't, you know, experiment with it and try and get the best out of it. Definitely, it's going to cost more to trellis. So you've got to weigh up whether your costs that you put into your management are actually bearing fruit, excuse the pun, on the other side. So that's something that you've got to take into consideration, especially with trellising, when it does cost a little bit more.
You mentioned some of the other countries that have gone into the high density orchards and plantings. Is there anywhere else in Australia that's slightly moving into this?
Yeah, there's a couple of growers in Queensland who are experimenting with it. Andy Fife is one that comes to mind, but there's some other growers as well. It's a little bit more hard to control your tree in the warm subtropics like Queensland and, you know, further north in the tropics, whereas here in the southwest we've got a much shorter growing season, so it actually lends itself better to high density production in the cooler southwest.
Dudley Mitchell, he's an avocado grower and he's also the 2018 Nuffield Scholar, talking to Tyne Logan. And on his travels around the world this year, well, look at all these places he's going to: South America, Chile, Peru, California, Israel, south of South Africa, and New Zealand. And Andy Pfeiffer, who Dudley was mentioning there, the Bundaberg avocado grower, who is sort of playing around with some of these ideas. He's only a couple of years into growing his avocados in a high-density system. So Andy Pfeiffer's got 1,100 trees to the hectare, but yet to harvest the crop. So still, it's a bit of a wait and see, I guess, to see how it turns out before making a full assessment. 9 to 1, ABC, WA.
The Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Local Radio, WA.
Indonesia looks set to start exporting mangoes to Australia. This is after a trade deal was finalised between the two nations just last week in Melbourne. It was all signed and sealed. According to the Indonesian media, the first trays of Indonesian mangoes are set to arrive in October, and that's going to put them in direct competition with the Australian harvest. And while some growers are saying that they're pretty angry about that deal, the fact that they're coming in right at the time when the local fruit coming onto the market, the CEO of Australia's Mango Industry Association, Robert Gray, is staying pretty calm. He's speaking here to Matt Bran.
Australia and Indonesia have been negotiating to get access into Australia for about 25 years. It's been a fairly long, thorough process, making sure that if and when trade does happen, there's no pests and diseases that make their way into Australia that we don't have or want. In November 2015, Australia reached agreement with three countries, Thailand, Indonesia and Vietnam, on a broad process for how they would get access into Australia. And it's taken, since November 2015 for the specific process that Australia is happy to receive mangoes to be finalised. As you'd be aware, last year, Vietnam gained access to the Australian market with mangoes, and Thailand, which was the third country, are still working through the process of finalising their arrangements for access to Australia.
It's understood that the first Indonesian mangoes could arrive in October, putting them in direct competition with the Australian harvest. How does that make you feel?
Really, I don't think it's a major concern for Australian growers. Mid-season in the Australian mango market. Australian mangoes have secured a very strong position in the Australian market with consumers and with retailers, where our product, our Australian-grown product, is their mango of choice. It's been a strong focus of industry to make sure that the product, the quality of the product, the varieties we grow, the way we supply it and market align very closely with what the Australian market's looking for. And, all of the information I'm getting is, we will continue to receive, full support from the Australian marketplace for our Australian-grown products this season and for seasons to come.
But money talks, doesn't it? If these mangoes start landing at a distinctly cheaper cost than the Aussie mangoes, is that not a concern?
No, I don't think so. Experience has shown us, we've had Indian mangoes, Pakistani mangoes, Vietnamese mangoes, all been given access to Australia over recent years. And, they've all struggled to, capture any foothold in our marketplace. because, you know, our industry has been very good at delivering great mangoes to the marketplace. You know, our product doesn't require irradiation, it doesn't require vapor heat, it, you know, it doesn't require any unnecessary chemicals. It's, you know, varieties that the Australian consumers have grown up with and love, you know, that wonderful KP flavour, which is, you know, part of all of our varieties we supply. I think if we, as an industry, continue to focus on, you know, what we do well, we have nothing to fear here.
Robert Gray, he's the CEO of the Australian Mango Industry Association. In a statement from the Federal Department of Agriculture, it really confirms things for you. It says Indonesia is seeking access for mango fruit through the irradiation treatment, and an approach was agreed to at a meeting held in Melbourne, as I mentioned earlier. It's expected that the systems and procedures for this treatment will be in place in time for the upcoming mango export season, which is expected to start in September. 5-1. Well, not all Australian mango growers agree with what Robert Gray has just been telling you. Leo Skliros is a grower in the Northern Territory, and he's not looking forward to competition coming in from Indonesia.
I've read that they're going to be coming in October, and that's right at the start of our season. I heard Robert Gray saying that it was in the middle of Australian season. I think he needs to relook at that. There's a small amount of fruit coming off before that, but the bulk of the Darwin industry, which is the first cab off the rank, basically, is setting in from around mid-October. And, I really don't like it, because I've seen many times they say, well, if it's irradiated, that it guarantees there's no pest or disease coming in. I find that very hard to believe. There's always a way, whether it comes in through the shipping containers or, you know, the process. We have to remember the process of irradiation is not an exact science. And we have to remember it's being done in Indonesia. It's not being done in Australia, where, you know, it's monitored and there's a strict guideline around every procedure from growing to the irradiation to everything else. We don't know how that fruit's being treated prior to irradiation as well, because there's no quality assurance programs in these countries. And any bad news on the marketplace concerning mangoes affects the price of Australian mangoes.
Northern Territory mango grower Leo Skliros.
Join us for The World Today.
Hello, I'm Thomas Ariti on the program today. If you're sweating on a clue about whether you'll get a pay rise soon, we'll tell you about the latest official figures on wages growth. South Australia sets a massive new renewable energy target. And is the US about to change course on gun control? The president moves to outlaw a device that allows a rifle to shoot hundreds of rounds a minute.
The key in all of these efforts is that we cannot merely take actions that make us feel like we are making a difference. We must actually make a difference.
More than the headlines, The World Today.
Tracy Kilner here with the details of the Katanning sheep market. How'd it go, Tracy?
Hi, Belinda. We had a smaller yarding today, 14,334 sheep. All categories of lamb eased on quality, with the plain lightweight pens hard to sell. Mutton prices increased for the prime line, selling to a top of $131 a head, while the quality of store use brought their prices back. Weather prices were up this week with competition from processors and restockers. A pen of heavy lambs topped the market at $148 a head. The lightweight lambs made from $80 to $116 a head. Lambs suitable for air freight sold from $94 to $118. Trade weight lambs made from $125 to $135. And the heavyweight lambs sold to $148 a head. Store lambs made from $10 for the immature and plain lambs to $140 a head for good framed lambs to feedlot buyers. The lambs suitable for live export made from $85 to $126 a head. The young black tag ewes sold to butchers from $55 for stores and up to $122 for the heavy lines. Restockers paid from $20 for plain stores up to $120 a head for the breeder ewes. Lightweight mutton sold for $50 to $69 a head, trade mutton made from $85 to $105, while the heavy mutton made from $95 to $131 a head with a fleece. Weather's gained, with restockers paying $84 for the light weather lambs and up to $138 for the large framed weathers. Processors paid $77 to $137 a head, depending on weight. Older slaughter rams made from $10 up to $100 a head, depending on age, weight and quality. And the young rams to feeder buyers, they paid $23 for the light plain lines and up to $121 for the heavier, better quality lambs. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you for that, Tracy. I'm Belinda Varaschetti, back with another Country Hour tomorrow, news time, 1 o'clock.